Is it possible to manage pain without drugs? Today's guest and I are going to dive into this and so much more. So stay tuned. Welcome back, my friends. My name is Sarah. This is the Sarah Kleiner Wellness YouTube channel. Today, I have an interview with Dr. Mauro Zapatera, and this is a fascinating, deep interview. I actually feel like I could have talked to him another 2 hours. So if you want me to bring him back on, if you have questions, go ahead and comment in the comment section below so that we can maybe have more dialogue. But Dr. Zapatera has studied the cerebral spinal fluid extensively and the impact of energy and how this impacts our overall health. Now, he is an MD, PhD, in Harvard MD, PhD, and he has a practice in Pasadena, California, where he actually helps people manage pain without drugs. And this is something that we don't have enough of in our society. So I'm really excited to bring him on. He also has some really amazing children's books that I have ordered all for myself. I'm going to be reading to my children. I'm so excited. But he has some really, really amazing information that I'm excited to share with you. I'm excited to bring him to you, my audience. So I hope that you enjoy this episode. If you do, make sure to hit the like button, share this video with a friend, share it with a family member, especially if they're struggling with their health and maybe they've tried everything and they have lost hope. And here is something different that we need to look at. I really feel like it's kind of the circle that we go in when it comes to our health. So again, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Before I jump in, a couple quick thank yous to my sponsors. The first one is going to be Viva Rays. They have fantastic circadian glasses. You can use my code YOGI to save 15% there. They also have great earplugs and eye masks. And the second one is Upgraded Formulas. Mineral balance is so hugely important to our overall health. And Upgraded Formulas has a fantastic hair tissue mineral analysis with a consultation that can help you get to the bottom of your mineral needs. Use my code YOGI12 or YOGI to save there. And I love their magnesium. It is fantastic as well. So thank you so much for watching today's podcast and let's jump into it. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Super honored and excited to have Dr. Mauro with us here today. And we're going to talk about some interesting things. We've talked a lot about water on the channel, but I think this is going to take this to a bit of a different level for many of you. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me. Super honored to be here as well.
Yeah. Well, I've been watching a lot of your videos over the last couple of weeks and just really interested to share a lot of this information with my audience. So if you wouldn't mind just giving a bit of background of your history and, you know, your medical practice and all the amazing things that you've done.
For sure. Yeah. So I graduated from Harvard Medical School with an MD PhD. And what that is you go through 2 or 3 years of medical school, and then you sort of leave the medical school behind, you go off and do a PhD. And then after you've completed your PhD, you come back and finish medical school, you go back to the clinical years, and then hopefully it kind of all informs each other. And you know, you try to make good decisions about what you're interested in and stuff like that. And my journey was a little, was a beautiful journey in that time period, because that's also when I met my now wife. Mm-hmm. And it, right when I was trying to decide what to do research on, we met, and, she saw that I wasn't in the right space, let's say. I wasn't in the right place to be doing research, or it's sort of like there was something that was unfulfilling that she noticed. And she actually, you know, she's like, hey, let's take some time off and go and do something else. And she was very interested in holistic healing modalities, and I was as well. I took some time off. I didn't think it could be done, but she kind of convinced me to go ask. And as soon as I asked, it was like, yeah, you know, do what you want. Like, we don't want to force you to. So it's fantastic. Really, really kind of opening. And you know, I was a little shocked, to be honest with you, but you know, they gave me this opportunity to say, look, we'll just put everything on pause, right? You can go off, you know, 8 months, 9 months, whatever it is. And so we left and we went to Santa Fe, and we actually studied at the New Mexico Academy of Healing Arts. And we were always interested. She was interested in naturopathic medicine and things like that. Actually thought of going to an ND school. But just the time that was invested in that was too long. And so we found different kind of training areas that we could do for, you know, like 800 hours or 700 hours or whatever it might be, that we could be exposed to and learn. And so what we did is we actually started learning about polarity therapy. We started learning about craniosacral therapy, just various sort of hands-on healing modalities that involved diet, that involved nutrition, that involved movement of the body, that involved hands-on applications, and also hands-off applications, and also that involved counseling, like positive thinking, meditation, mindfulness, things like that. And that's really when my curiosity, let's say, sparked in the cerebrospinal fluid, because what we did is, you know, you as a student, you'd have to give sessions, whatever those sessions would be, whether they're polarity sessions or we were starting to learn craniosacral. And I didn't know anything about hands-on healing. I mean, I did, because my mom did some massage, shiatsu, things like that, and pressure points in the feet. And I could always feel like, I always felt like there was energy coming out of my hands and we could, you could not make contact with somebody, but they could still feel that there was sort of this energetic, but it was always like, you know, 1 or 2 inches away from my hand. So I was always interested in things like chakras and energy meridians and acupuncture and acupressure. And, you know, it's like, if you push something on your foot here, it can affect the head and, you know, all these sorts of things. And I'm like, look, these practices have got thousands and thousands of years of history behind them. And to not integrate those sorts of practices into my medical education felt like I was kind of missing something. Right. Mm. So I was kind of open to it, right? But still skeptic. I was still like, you know, I didn't want to just accept everything, right? Like stick your thumb in your mouth and suck it, and that's going to heal everything, you know? My background was still this very sort of hardcore, intense MD PhD, where you're designing research, you're trying to understand, you know, you're creating hypotheses, you're testing those hypotheses and things. So that was kind of that underlying, right? It's like, I'm not sure that doesn't make sense to me. Mm. But this could, right? What are the possibilities that are out there? And so I was always interested in sort of, you know, investigating those possibilities. And so that's when I became interested in the cerebrospinal fluid. Essentially, I was giving a session and getting sessions of craniosacral, and I just felt this pulsation that was occurring, that was coming up my body. It felt like it was connected to everything, and it was a very purely energetic sensation of this pulsation that was arising up my body through my spine, and that was coalescing. There was a coalescence in the middle of my brain. And because I had done so much anatomy, I knew that, like, it was sort of like, if I tried to locate it in anatomy, you know, if you feel like a pain in your belly, right? You're like, oh, is that my heart, right? Am I having a heart attack? No, that's a little lower. You know, these are the things that we do in like a differential diagnosis. No, that seems more like it's the appendix or, you know, whatever it is. And so that's exactly what I did, right? It was just like somebody comes in, they said, oh, I'm feeling this thing, I go right here. You're going to ask questions about, what does it feel like? Where, you know, does it go anywhere? Does it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So using the medical training I got, I was like, you know, this really feels like it's in the middle of my brain. It feels like it's really in the third ventricle. And I had no idea what the cerebrospinal fluid, you know, we knew that the cerebrospinal fluid was sort of a buffer, a cushion to the brain. It had some electrolytes, but, you know, its function was really more of just providing a cushion to the brain, you know, creating a buoyancy. This was something that was that I felt over and over again. And I assessed to see if it was my heart rate. It wasn't my heart rate. You know, I put my fingers on my carotid artery or my radial pearl pulse, and I had a different movement than that. it wasn't my respirations. I could, you know, sense my respirations. And I'm like, wow, there's something, there's some other movement. There's some other sort of energy here that's present. And so I went up to the teacher and I said, you know, I'm feeling, this is what I'm feeling. And it's reproducible. It comes every time. It's very symmetric, but it's very abundant. It's everywhere, but it can be localized. So it's sort of this interesting, you know, I hadn't ever sort of experienced this. And I had no preconceived notions of the cerebrospinal fluid. And all he said was, you know, that might be your, sounds like that's your cerebrospinal fluid pulsating. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. You know, does this pulsate, right? Like, anyways, so the next sentence, so, you know, so when people always say things, I always go, oh, that's interesting. You know, could it be, what are the mechanisms that that could happen, et cetera? Are there things that we haven't discovered? You know, that to me is science, is sort of like, is like going into the undiscoverable and finding those things. And so the next statement he said was essentially, you know, it was like, oh, and it's one molecule away from seawater. And I said, that doesn't sound right, but I have never studied the CSF so deeply to actually know whether or not that was. But then I went home that night and I looked it up and I said, what are the contents of the cerebrospinal fluid? And it was not one water. It is not one molecule away from seawater. And that's the curiosity, right? It's sort of like, okay, it's not one, but what do we know about, what do we know about this fluid? Okay. Mm-hmm. And so then I started investigating this fluid just personally and being like, wow, this is, you know, it's in the middle of your spine. So you have a hollow canal in the middle of your spinal cord, and it goes all the way down the middle of your spinal cord. It comes all the way up. It bathes the inside of your brain in these things called the ventricles, sort of these fluid filled cavities in the middle of your brain. We have a fourth ventricle in right next to the cerebellum. We have the third ventricle, which is literally a midline structure right in the middle of your brain. We have lateral ventricles, which are these beautiful sort of wings that go into the that are on both sides of the brain. They go from the front all the way to the back. They curve down. If you've never seen pictures of it, I highly recommend it. It's actually really, really beautiful to see what the ventricles look like in 3D. Some people describe it as like a bird flying with the beak, and then these large ventricles on the side, and then the tail coming down into the fourth ventricle and cerebellum. And so I just became very interested in, I was like, wow, that's like those are some that's some interesting space in the middle of our brain, you know, and it covers the outside of the brain. We are constantly creating it. So we're producing it, absorbing it. It's a very dynamic fluid. And for us not to have really understood it as a functioning fluid, was an opening for me, like, wow, we don't actually know so much about it. And when I looked at the contents of the cerebrospinal fluid, we didn't really know much about what was in it. And I'm like, you know, this is too important. This is the location of the fluid was too sacred, let's say, for it just to have like seven or eight molecules and just to provide a buffer.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, anytime you're looking at completing a PhD, especially at Harvard, where they really want you to sort of design your own thesis and come up with your own experiments, finding something like this that had just a wide open exploration field was sort of like a holy grail, in essence, of like, wow, we don't really know much about this fluid. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of low hanging fruit, essentially, in terms of studies that could be done that I could get my thesis and complete my PhD and move on, essentially, you know. And so that's exactly so, you know, we did this. I completed my wife and I completed this training program. I completely shifted my focus in research and found a lab that was working on brain development. And in that lab proposed this as a, you know, just to investigate this fluid as a research thesis for my PhD. And the principal investigator, Dr. Walsh, was just absolutely, this is incredible. This is amazing. So saw the potential of it as well. And so that just led me down a journey of not only investigating the cerebrospinal fluid from a very, very scientific perspective, but also during that time period, my wife and I also flew back to Boulder every 3 months and studied biodynamic craniosacral therapy. So we were giving sessions, we were receiving sessions in that modality while I was also, you know, looking at the fluid under the microscope. Studying the fluid, you know, just trying to really understand it as it's as a very basic molecular, biomolecular, you know, biological, physiological fluid that's in the middle of our brain and what it actually does. So that's a little bit of my background. Now I focus on I'm a physician. I focus on pain management, and I'm really, I sort of call myself a non-pharmaceutical, non-interventional, you know, pain management specialist, really looking at just trying to come up with ways of how the body can try to heal itself and how we can help decrease pain without using medications or injections or surgery, understanding that those are absolutely needed and required. At times, but how can we employ the brain, the mind, this fluid? What are some of the practices that we can actually do that can help increase our quality of life, that can help increase our functioning, that are more holistic, that are that encompass more than just medications, injections, and surgery? And so I run our multidisciplinary program, and these are programs that can last anywhere between 16 to 160 hours of multidisciplinary care, where it's myself, a physical therapist, a psychologist, all working together to try to help improve function, decrease suffering, and focusing on really, you know, how are you breathing? How is the nervous system regulated or not? And really trying to balance a lot of sort of basic biological, physiological parameters in the body, and then seeing how chronic pain can sort of follow in that treatment.
Yeah, and it's a huge business. I've had my mother went through non-Hodgkin's lymphoma back in 97, and she just did so many of these treatments that it kind of broke her body down, and she dealt with a lot of pain to the point where she got an epidural block and ended up being paralyzed in 2007. And so it's like a lot of these treatments, you know, I think sometimes they are medically necessary to help people manage pain, but, you know, just kind of watching my mom go through what she's been through over the last, you know, 20 some odd years, I haven't seen that a lot of the interventions that they've given her for pain to be helpful and supportive. You know, it's like she's in a wheelchair now, and it's just sad. And I see a lot of people that are really struggling with pain, and they kind of are only in this biochemical model, if you will. Like, it's just like, let's load them with medications and never consider these other things that you talk about. And Reiki was part of your learning as well, right? I don't know many Harvard trained doctors that also are understanding of Reiki and those types of energy.
I mean, you know, when you're in relationship with somebody, you know, my wife and I, we have a good relationship, and you know, you feel the energy between somebody else, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
So like, how could this not be something that is actually like studied and applied and used, you know, with your children or loved ones, but then also other people, right? And so there are, you know, people are looking at things like Reiki. Even at the Brigham and Women's Hospital where I studied, you know, there was a group of nurses who was looking at hands-on healing and Reiki effects, you know, looking at things like post-operative pain and areas that are much needed. And, you know, there are some really good studies that have shown effect. And so, you know, again, kind of going back, like, you know, like, why would I choose to do, well, it's your experience, right? So already it's like, wow, I feel you feel this energy between somebody. And so what is that, right? Like, we want to inquire, right? And so that's a really big part of my practice now, is that inward inquiry, that you feel something, let's investigate it, right? From every perspective that we have. And so that's, you know, sort of like, let's study Reiki, you know, and we became Reiki masters and did it on ourselves, and, you know, just, it's just something to explore again and see, you know, how does it work? If it doesn't work, who cares? Like, if it doesn't work for you, who cares? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's
right.
Not like, it's like, oh, well, that, you know, that was interesting. We got to spend some time together and put our hands on each other. It's like, right. At the end of the day, it's like, what's the big deal? Right. And, you know, we do it. It's like, it helps, it works. And so, you know, why not add that as a modality?
Absolutely. I mean, I did teach yoga for 13 years, kind of before I got into what I'm doing now. And it was all led through trying to help family members, trying to help my daughter, trying to figure that everything I've done is kind of been like personally motivated by something else. And then you end up opening all these other doors and meeting all these other people all over the world. And it's just interesting when you kind of allow things to open that way, what you stumble upon and what happens.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like this sort of dance, right? It's kind of this flow. It's like, oh, I'm going to go into here. Oh, wait, this doesn't seem like,
right.
Those amoebas are, you know, it's like those, the plasma that's like investigating a new environment and then coming out and sensing and moving and stuff like that. Right. And that's that, to me, that's life, right?
Yeah.
It's like this just constant flow, this ebbing and flowing in and out, you know, it's like, oh, that, you know, that energy doesn't seem very cohesive, right? You know, I'm going to just pull this little, my little pod out, you know, I'm going to check over here and things like that. And before you know it, you have this interdisciplinary web with these things going, you know, in all these different directions. And that to me is beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess my biggest question is, and my audience, they're very familiar with water, and we've had Dr. Pollock on, we've did a long episode with Veda Austin. You know, a lot of people, we kind of run in the same circles, Jen Isabel Friend, we've talked about a lot of those things. So how does the cerebral spinal fluid play into this, molecular water, in our body?
That's a great question. So many different ways. And these are all ways that, you know, I think we're actually looking to study, each one of these ways. So a lot of these are hypothetical, but yet, there's a real strong connection that many people have with water, or have seen water, perform certain things, like Veda, for instance, her crystal pictures of water, holding energy or transmitting information. You know, the question is, can water or fluid actually transmit some sort of energetic information? And what we're starting to see is that there's a real possibility that it is, that it can. And so we want to, you know, we want to understand and study all the different ways that it can. So just looking at, you know, the CSF, it's primarily composed of water. So it's about 99% water. Everything else is, you know, hormones and growth factors and things like that. So everything that you've heard about water, or the potential properties of water, essentially the cerebrospinal fluid may have that capacity to do. So it may actually have the capacity to hold information, to store information, to transmit that information. Now, if we take a step back, right, and say, well, do we have any, you know, do we have any proof of that? Well, it is water is a medium to transmit energy. First of all, we know that, for instance, if you drop any electrical current in water, it's going to transmit quickly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
So we know that it transmits quickly. When we put, for instance, in one of the procedures that is done is, you know, a spinal cord stimulator in people. That's actually an energetic current that, you know, we actually have to place very on the spine, because if it's in the fluid, it actually goes through the fluid. So it actually has to be on the spine. And we know that the electricity through the fluid actually transmits much faster than if it was actually on the spine. And if it's in the spine, then it can actually go up, you know, up the tissue. But through the fluid, it goes through the fluid instantaneously. So we know that water actually can transmit electrical information. And just taking it, you know, even one step closer to the biomolecular functioning is we know that, you know, whether it's the blood or the cerebrospinal fluid, we know that hormones or neurotransmitters or drugs or anything get transmitted through the fluid. You can have a drug that is administered into your blood, and then all of a sudden you feel it in a different area of the body, or you feel it throughout your whole body, right? And so we know now that from the research that we did, and the research that has come out, we know that the cerebrospinal fluid holds neurotransmitters, it holds growth factors. And we know that the fluid is absolutely essential for actually transmitting those growth factors to different parts of the brain. During development, that's what we studied. We studied very closely what this fluid actually did during development. But we also know it does it in the adult too, that it takes factors, growth factors, using the fluid to actually transmit the information to different parts of the brain, which is amazing. We know that it does it with things like melatonin, for instance. There's really good research out of the University of Texas looking at melatonin secretion from the pineal gland into the fluid, and the concentration increasing in the cerebrospinal fluid, bathing the entire brain. And it activates, it's increased at night when there's less light, and then it decreases during the day. So there's very, you know, we know that, for instance, there's a mechanism of, oh, I'm sensing less light, my pineal gland is going to start releasing melatonin, it goes into the cerebrospinal fluid, it goes through the fluid and it bathes the entire brain, and now I'm sensing more light, I'm going to shut down the melatonin production in my pineal gland, and I'm going to see that the melatonin decreases in the cerebrospinal fluid. They've actually done very, very detailed studies looking at that. So if we know that the fluid can transmit these molecules, right, can transmit biomolecules, can transmit, you know, neurotransmitters, growth factors, et cetera, what else can it transmit? What else can it transmit? And I think that's where we're getting into, you know, it transmitting electricity, transmitting light, transmitting information based on fluid resonance or fluctuations in the fluid, right? If you do something, for instance, and these are some of the studies that we're looking to fund, and I'll go into that a little bit later. You know, looking at something like Morse code, right? It's like a series of beats, or, you know, it's like deet, 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 right? What if our bodies actually had that same level of transmission of information transmission, yeah, of energy transmission? What if there is a certain resonance that a practice induced within the fluid that created a certain resonance on the inside of the ventricle of the brain, and that actually gave the brain certain information based on a pure vibration, on a resonance of something, right? That's absolutely plausible, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Why should we not investigate that, right?
Yeah.
Because people don't think it may it may be present, or they think it's so outside the box that they don't want to study it. And that's some of the resistance that we're actually getting. So purely from it's 99% water, but it also has this, so water has this ability to transmit chemicals, mm-hmm, right? If I put a drop of blue dye over here, and the pool was this big, right? In a period of time, the blue dye would be over here. So I can transmit, I could put something here and it can transmit throughout the entire pool, right? So just think of any activity that you're doing, whether you're activating the fluid in your sacrum, whether you're dancing and doing, you know, belly dancing movements, let's say, or any sort of dancing, whether you're doing yoga and you're doing certain postures, inverted poses, whatever it might be, that you're actually causing this fluid to move or resonate in some way. Well, you're definitely going to be moving the molecules in there. You're definitely going to be moving the any sort of chemical neurotransmitter, growth factors, anything like that. But what other information could you actually be, could you actually be transmitting? And so, going back to Dr. Pollack's work then, and we've actually tried to send him cerebrospinal fluid to see if it does go into the fourth phase. Mm-hmm. They need something like 300 milliliters of cerebrospinal fluid. And that's just like, it's a lot of
cerebrospinal. Yeah.
And so, the most that we would get from one person, from a lumbar puncture that doesn't have to go through analysis, so it'd have to be, is let's say anywhere from 15 to 20, 20 milliliters, which is a good amount. But then, we'd have to do that to 10, 20, 25 people. Yeah. But, is combining the cerebrospinal fluid from different people.
Are you going to get the same?
Is that going to get exactly? Right. So there's all these questions, right? So we're still thinking about how to actually do it, or if the technology changes such that we can use less fluid, right? He's in the 300 milliliters range. We're in the, we're in the 10 microliters, right?
Right.
It's sort of like we have microliters of cerebrospinal fluid that we can send. Anyways, just looking at Dr. Pollack's work, for instance, if it is water and and the cerebrospinal fluid go into this fourth phase, can it actually create an exclusion zone? Mm-hmm. And well, what has Dr. Pollack worked? Well, Dr. Pollack has shown that essentially some energy goes into the fluid, and as that energy goes into the fluid and some of the things that he's shown is actually like infrared light.
That was going to bring up infrared light and cerebral spinal fluid. Yes. Yeah.
So think of like infrared light, right? He's just shown it infrared light, water goes into the fourth phase. Yeah. Now it creates this exclusion zone. Mm-hmm. And he's shown that it can actually happen close to a hydrophilic surface. Hydrophilic means water loving.
Yes.
Well, the membrane of the cells, the external membrane of the cells, is membrane loving. And so is water loving.
Yes.
And so the inside of our brain that's bathing the inside of the ventricles that's bathing the cerebrospinal fluid is a hydrophilic surface. Mm-hmm. So you have a hydrophilic surface, you have water, right? Now you can think, okay, wow, well, could the cerebrospinal fluid actually go into a fourth phase? Mm. Depending on, could there be certain situations, certain energy inputs that we could do consciously or unconsciously, or that happen spontaneously, that cause this cerebrospinal fluid to go into a fourth phase? And that creates this exclusion zone. And now you have this difference of electrolytes. And anytime you have a difference of electrolytes, now you have this internal battery that has been created. You actually have an internal source of energy.
Yes.
Right. So when you think about it's within you, right? All these sorts of like, I haven't gone down this, but that's sort of like where I'm going, is even all these, biblical texts or the language that we use, illuminated,
yes,
enlightenment, it within you, right? I've quoted Yogananda actually saying, you recharge the battery. What does that mean? Right.
Right.
That there's electricity. People feel an electrical movement. Again, yoga, the spine is the altar of God. Yes, we can poo-poo all that, but like the we've got to look into all these.
We right? have we to can't. Ask why we're poo-pooing it. I mean, and I think it's just so much that we've been conditioned that this is all some dangerous, my mother is one of these, like, God love her, very, very like Southern Baptist, like very kind of like, don't look at this other world stuff. It's like, you know,
silly,
ungodly.
Silly.
And I'm like, but mom, it's in the Bible though. Like you were just saying, the biblical text contains, it's in all of these historical texts. And I was talking about homeopathy recently because my son had a fever and my husband was like, hey, it's Tylenol. And I'm like, no, I'm going to do some homeopathy and give him Keaton isotonic fluids and just, you know, he'll be fine. He's 14 months. And just talking about homeopathy and how that was wiped out. And so many of these different schools of thought, like that the way we used to look at the body, the way that we used to heal was a lot of these energy modalities. And a lot of that was wiped out with Rockefeller medicine. And, you know, the term quack was invented. And, you know, it's just like the way that our society thinks now is like this biochemical has to be in this specific model. And they don't question like where that came from or look at this other side of the water, right? The water in our bodies, the molecular cellular water, and now the cerebral spinal fluid as well. That these, you know, and in our biofield too, that's something I've been kind of looking into as well. It's like these things kind of can hold more clues to our health. You don't have to wipe out the whole biochemical model, obviously, because you're Harvard doctor, but there's, like you said, there's so much value to understanding these other things as well, right?
Exactly. And I think limiting your scope of investigation is in my opinion, limiting your scope of inquiry and discovery. And so, you know, keeping just continuously keeping that open, being like, well, could it be?
Yeah.
Right. And as new and more subtler technologies come out that we can actually measure these things, mm-hmm. We're going to start seeing that a lot of this stuff is very relevant, and very powerful and very, you know, it's got a huge potential. And so, you know, I think that's where we're at. And it's finding people that are brave enough to do the studies. You know, we've proposed a few studies on water. I'm working with Dr. Deep, who is, you know, born in Benares, Varanasi, India, and has a fundamental understanding of nadi water. And essentially this is like sort of the primordial water. He says it's the, you know, there's 72,000 nadi channels in the human body, and he has an intimate relationship with all of them. And, you know, he actually reached out to me because he said the cerebrospinal fluid holds the nadi essence from the water that's present in the first cell of the human. So
the embryo, yeah.
So if you think of that, right. So if you think of, what was the energy of the water in the egg as the sperm is fertilizing it to create a child? And that, so that's,
it's like that zinc
all
spark.
Potential. Yes, yeah. That's the spark. Yeah. That's totipotency. That is light. All potential.
Yeah.
And then as we differentiate this water essence, like you're talking about homeopathy, right? That homeopathic, that there's a homeopathic quality to the water in all of our cells. And that's his nadi water. And he says, well, it's really expressed in the cerebrospinal fluid as well, because it's water. So we contacted and we've been working, and we've been trying to propose a very simple experiment. I do more clinical research on people, but, you know, I don't have a tissue culture room where I can like grow cells. And you need certain like licenses and stuff like that. I've just moved away from like the hardcore kind of lab stuff, but anybody who works in tissue culture, it's a super simple experiment. And so, you know, we've proposed this, we've had all the funding, we've had initial seed money, we've had everything from, you know, seed money of tens of thousands of dollars to millions of dollars in terms of depending on what results we get, because we're not attached to the results. We're just seeing like, hey, can we do a proof of concept experiment? Here's the experiment. Okay. And some of the replies we get literally have been, you know, we can't do the research because if it actually is true, I don't know how I would be able to describe it or explain it. And I'm like,
really? So that's,
I'm like, wait a second. Isn't that what research is?
Right. Exactly.
Like, if all the research we did, we knew how to explain it, and we're like, what's the point? Okay, I see. You're in this little box, and you want to stay in that box, and that's what, you know. But you know, I was just shocked. It's like I've been shocked by some of these responses, and I'm like, well, dude, like, okay, well, you know, if it. So, I think that's kind of a big issue, right? Is if you're not willing to investigate and explore, and so maybe we just haven't found the right, you know, maybe we haven't found the right people. But I've asked a lot of different people, and you know, for me to get those sorts of responses, I was pretty surprised.
I hope you're enjoying today's episode with Dr. Mauro Zapatera. All of his information will be in the show notes. I highly encourage you to go follow him on Instagram. Get his children's books, support his work in any way that you can. I think it is absolutely important and crucial to getting this information out. And a quick little reminder, I'm still having my December sale. You can still save up to 50% on some of my courses through the end of December. That link will be in the show notes for you if you're interested in getting some extra savings. And all of my free resources are also in the information section as well. All right, let's go ahead and jump back into today's episode. Yeah, from where I'm sitting, I'm not. but it's people, you kept saying the word resonance, and that has been coming up a lot for me lately, just looking at our health, you know, and this whole like resonance effect, and even thinking about getting sick, you know, and you catch a cold, or you catch, you know, a quote unquote virus, or you catch something. And I've been kind of exploring this idea of resonance with the person that has this, you know. It's interesting because my husband will get really sick, and we'll literally sleep in the same bed together, and I'm fine. Like, I never catch what he has, and he never catches what I have. It's super bizarre, right? I'm like, it's because maybe I'm not resonating with what he has going on. But my son will get sick, you know, he's a 14-month-old, and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna fight. And then sure as heck, I'll come down with whatever he's had, you know? So I feel like there's something to, you know, even catching illnesses and just this whole like resonance effect that goes on in the body in regards to our health, period. Would you say?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, resonance is just another form of energy, a form of communication. So, you know, when I use these words, it's not anything that we are, that we don't know in the past. You know, a guitar string is resonating to create a chord, a sound. Yes. Yeah. Right. And then you're listening to that sound. And because we have the receptors that can hear that sound, then we say, oh, that's such a beautiful, but do you know how much resonance there is out, or how much just frequency vibrations there are in the world that we don't actually have the gross receptors to perceive? But I do believe that we do have those subtle receptors and the subtle capacity to actually perceive that. And that is actually something that I think we should be teaching our kids in school, is the, that interoception, more of a subtle, felt sense than, you know, just, okay, here's touch, here's sight, here's smell, here's this, here's that. And, you know, we're going to teach you how to speak and listen. But that's resonance, right? I pluck a string on a guitar and you hear it. That's resonance. And that's a form of communication, because now I can pluck two different strings that have two different resonances, and and that's just two different notes, right? And if C said, you know, love, and D was you, then I could go C and D, and that'd be love you. Right. So it's just a form of energy transfer. And so if we look at that energy transfer as, wow, how is energy being transferred, right? Well, we know that it's being transferred electromagnetically. We know that there's energy everywhere, right? From our from our radio waves to the TV antennas to 5G to everything, right? Mm-hmm. But also internally, how our cells are producing and working, and how our brains are creating electromagnetic waves from the thoughts that we have, from the heart, how it's beating. So it's a big mix.
Yeah.
And so could we actually do practices or ingest foods or drink water that helps to bring a certain resonance more towards health and healing, mm-hmm. and vibrancy, and to create a situation that may actually enlighten, right? That may actually bring one closer to compassion, to love, to kindness. Then another resonance or another energy frequency that might bring us more close to things like you know, hatred or fear. And so just sort of paying attention to that for yourself and asking that question. For me, it's like, we're all an N of one, and the greatest Petri dish that you have is your own body, is your own self. And so that's the greatest experiment, right? Well, oh, you know, let me be open to this possibility. And for 5-10 days, you do a certain, you know, you sort of do an experiment on you,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, let me shift away from, you know, Fox News and CNN, and let me bring in this energy frequency. Mm-hmm. And let me just see, you know, let me document, let me see how I feel after 5 days. Let me change this water, right? Yes. Let me change this substance that I'm putting in my body, whatever yes. that might be. Let me change the sounds that I'm hearing, the things that I'm looking at, the you know, whatever it might be. And does it affect me? Now, it doesn't, just because you do it doesn't mean it has to, right?
Right.
But here we are, these amoebas, like, oh, you know, that worked. Oh, hey, that didn't. Oh my goodness, that, whoa, could that be, right? Is that possible? Like, wow, I just changed my drinking water, and I feel this increased yeah. vibrancy inside, right? Well, whoa. And now you're talking about resonance, right? So now I'm talking to you, and you're like, oh, I didn't really notice it. Well, okay. So how does that shift for that person based on how they're resonating, mm-hmm. it affect them at that time, and maybe not affect somebody else,
yeah.
right? That can definitely be a possibility as well. So that to me is the fun part of life,
yeah.
to be honest with you, is this just yeah. constant, like, you know, constant inquiry, investigation.
Yes.
In a field of, like, honestly, like in a field of love, like,
mm. yeah,
I'm not, you know, it's not okay. We'll go down that path. Let's do it. Right. And yeah. come back. But what's the underlying current?
Yeah.
Underlying current is love.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Informing it all. And that's, you know, that's it.
Yeah. I feel like that's when you are letting that be kind of the, like you said, underlying current of your life, you know, like you and your work and what you've continued to be led to do and learn. It sounds like that has been kind of that flow that continues to lead you in new directions and to learn new things. And I find that is definitely true for me. It's like, I'm constantly like talking with people, and I've got my own family members and people just coming into my field, and I'm like, I have to follow this path to understand that. And this doesn't make any sense to me. And maybe it won't in this lifetime, but I have to go this path. And that can be hard for people because they are just searching for, like specific protocols and specific, they want everything on paper to make sense. And sometimes it just isn't going to. Yeah, it just doesn't. You know, when people are like, what, you know, because when I was pregnant, I was like, I didn't do a bunch of prenatals. I did more like, I just would hold different supplements in my hands, like desiccated oysters and desiccated organ meats and quinton minerals. And I never really measured anything. I would just kind of hold it in my hand and be like, no, I don't need that today. Or no, I need like four of these today. And people will get so mad because they're like, well, how much are you taking? And how much? I'm like, I don't know. I just am kind of like letting it sit with me for a second and then saying, that doesn't feel right today. And I think that's just, people have become, like I said, so attached to protocols and like needing a specific map that they have lost touch with that. And your work is so keyed into that innate kind of knowing, right?
It's got to be. I mean, to be honest with you, when you do pain management, it's got to be, right? Because, you know, people can be really, you know, when people are in pain, it's like they can, they go through anything to try it, right? And so what do you trust first? Well, you're going to trust, you know, you're going to go to the doctor. They're going to give you probably injections, medications, you know, they're going to do imaging, try to find out what's wrong, which all makes sense, right?
Yeah.
You want to make sure there's nothing dangerous going on, that there's no like metastatic cancer, there's no infection, there's no like, you know, tear or rip that needs, you know, to be surgically repaired or anything like that. And then you go through, right? You people might spend years and years and years and years trying different medications or different things and they're, you know, and whatnot. And when you listen to their stories, you know, all of a sudden, you know, and I used to work at the VA too. You know, these vets who are in serious
so much pain,
right? Saying that, oh, you know, they went down and they went to, you know, they went to Mexico and they visited their old, you know, their old great grandmother or something like that. And this is what she, you know, she recommended this, like this topical oil that she makes in the back. And it's like, you know, and we were treating, you know, and so you hear these stories, right? Like we're treating this person with like injections and medications and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then they come back, right? And they tell you, like, you just listen to them and they tell you, they go, oh, I don't need my medication anymore. I went down and I got this, you know, I did this topical thing from this, you know, my great grandmother who's in Mexico. And she has this thing and she doesn't. And you're just like, what is that? Right.
Yeah,
like, and then they're like, oh yeah. And so I feel good right now. Now you obviously want to be careful, right? It's like, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to do something that's, you know, it's like, oh, ingest this. I have no idea what it is. Like, you know, there's gotta be some sense in it. But, you know, when people come back and tell you what they did when they've had so much experience and they finally are like, okay, I'm going to try something else. We have to be open to those possibilities. You know, I remember, I had a very good pain management attending at Harvard when I did my pain management, because he did a grand rounds and he said, you know, his question was, are we really practicing evidence-based medicine? And in, you know, you mentioned some like epidurals and things like that in the past, right? And he said, what's the evidence that the epidurals actually work? And are we actually practicing evidence-based medicine? And he looked up and he put up, you know, he said, look, I went to PubMed and I looked up all the treatments for that people have done, that people have published on chronic pain. He said, I found 127 individual treatments that people that have been published for chronic pain. He's like, how many of these do we prescribe in the clinic? And then he goes on and tells this story of this patient who had, you know, severe neck pain, was having these migraine headaches and was doing this and that. And, you know, I was surprised by the story because he said that, you know, we were doing epidural steroid injections. She was coming into the clinic for 5 years. We were trying to do this. We had done traction. We did, you know, she'd gone to a chiropractor, physical therapist, acupuncturist, you know, did cognitive behavioral therapy. And, you know, she's being very closely followed by this clinic that he was overwatching. And then, you know, she comes back and this is her story, right? We're out in Boston. She goes, you know, and she's like, oh yeah, I feel much better. And like, oh, what, you know, like now it's like, oh, what'd you do? Right. Like, I drove up to, there was somebody that told me about this person that did this, you know, and it actually ended up being craniosacral therapy. They're like, I drove up to this person. They told me about in Maine and I went and I got, you know, I'm like, nothing else is working if it's working, I'm still at the same place. Right. And so therefore, why not try it? Right. And so what was the modality? Oh, well, it's not anything dangerous. Right. So that's the first thing is like, we don't want to, you know, we want to make sure you're not taking a toxin or, you know, it's like, you know, doing anything that's like life threatening, let's say. But it was like, oh, it was biodynamic craniosacral therapy. And she's like, yeah, I went and they held my head in these different like kind of positions and postures. It was very subtle. There wasn't any high velocity movement, et cetera, et cetera. and got three sessions. And she's like, yeah, now my pain is like a 2 out of 10.
Wow.
And, you know, his question during the grand rounds was, like, what do we do with that? Mm-hmm. Do we go off and study that? Because we had been prescribing that person 5 years of medication and her pain was always at 7 out of 10, mm. 8 out of 10. We were doing repeat injections, right? And they go off and they do this one thing that hasn't really been looked at in the literature very well. And now more studies are coming out, but he was open to it, right? So there's this sort of like, wow, like you go out. So in pain management, we kind of have to be, because we can do, we can do what we can do, but people are going to go and explore, and they'll come back and tell us. And if we're listening, we'll be like, oh, wow, interesting. Right.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of the brilliance of it, because now people come back and tell us and they're like, well, this worked for me. This mm-hmm. worked for me. This worked for me. This worked for me. This worked for me. And at some certain point, you got to be like, okay,
open.
Let's pay attention to this. Right.
Yeah.
So there is a little bit of openness, now people are really looking at things like mindfulness and meditation, for chronic pain. And people are like, there's a group of people are like, there's no way that mindfulness can help chronic pain. And then now you're looking at the fMRI studies and actually showing
it. Yeah.
You can see it. You can see how mm-hmm. mindfulness can actually help chronic pain. Now, is it instantaneous? Well,
no,
believe it or not. 5 minutes of practice can actually start rewiring some of the, it can start sort of sending different signals to the brain. Mm-hmm. And if you're perceiving something differently, if you have the same sensory input, but you're perceiving it differently based on the way that the brain is receiving the signal, your experience is going to be different. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a different experience. And that's really what we're going for. So we're going for that change in experience. So we're starting to see it, and that's where it's exciting, where as new technologies come out that are able to see small changes in, let's say, brain connections or some really small changes in neurotransmitters, or discovering new neurotransmitters or growth factors or what that might be, or new technology that looks at more subtle energy, energy that maybe can pick up resonances and mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I think we're going to start to, it's really going to kind of open up a lot of these avenues for people to rest in and be okay with, as opposed to sort of keep on fighting against.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just as someone who taught yoga for 13 years, I don't do it anymore teaching. But I did see a lot of, I would meet people that it changed their life to have a breathwork practice or meditation practice and it helped me tremendously, of a lifetime of struggling with my weight and crippling anxiety and sleep issues. Like, that was why I taught, because, I had this kind of all these other stresses in my life going on, and I was able to go into practice and feel better. And it, everyone always just thought I was a weirdo and like it was woo-woo. But now, like you said, the science is kind of coming to back these things. So it's like it's coming. It's just, it's not out there as much as like the latest paper on taking XYZ supplement or XYZ medication to fix this issue. Yeah. So it's, good to kind of look for it. Yeah. So when you are working with somebody that has chronic pain, for instance, as a physician, what type of things, I think we've kind of already talked about it, but what type of things do you employ? Is it breath work? Is it meditation? Is it you kind of read the person and say, this might work better for them? Or how do you assess what's going to work for somebody?
Yeah, it's mostly listening to the patient, to be honest mm-hmm. with you, and seeing what, again, you talk about that resonance, like, mm-hmm. What have they done in the past? Where are they at? And starting there. And then, what are some of the, looking more at function and not really focusing on pain so much. Every time you focus on pain or ask them about their pain, for instance, all we're doing is just redirecting their attention back to the pain. Mm-hmm. And so we mostly focus on like function, like what do you feel like you're not able to do that you would like to do? A lot of them, it's like, I'd like to be able to lift my kids. I can't lift my kids, or I'd like to be able to get on the ground and play Legos, or, you know, I'd like to be able to return to work, or I'd like to be okay. And then we need to understand, like, right, why can you not get on the ground? Like, what is, you know, is it because you have, did you have a hip fracture and you had it repaired in the way that it was repaired? Like your hip doesn't actually move in that way because it's actually restricted. Or is it that you get to a certain point and you feel pain and then you stop? Right. And what is it? Why is it that you're actually feeling pain at that point? And what's the component of strengthening that needs to go into place? What's the component of stretching that needs to go into place, of creating some sort of dynamic flexibility, or simply like, I feel the pain and I stop because I'm so scared to go through that. And that there's actually nothing dangerous going on. It's just the fear comes up and it's inhibiting. So the first is really getting to know the person and then understanding like, what are some of the things that they have actually done that have helped? Because that actually helps to understand their resonance and their what are they open to? And so a lot of it initially comes from that, and then it actually comes from educating. So I know that this is what you've been told about pain, or you know that this is what maybe you've learned about pain. But what we have learned over the recent 20 years of actually studying it and researching it and trying to get a better understanding of it, this is what we know is the difference between acute and chronic pain, and how acute pain is really about a danger signal. And it's really important for evolutionary survival, for instance, where chronic pain is something different, but our brain can't understand that. It doesn't actually understand that because it still senses the signal. So can we just see this as let's just break this down and just say, look, if you have some sort of chronic pain, there may be a component that is that your brain is misinformed. And so we try to really understand, like, is there still danger in that chronic pain signal? And so we might get new imaging, right, to really kind of look, or new diagnostics or something. But a lot of the time it's, let's say, a signal that has gone awry, or an understanding, an interpretation of that signal that is wrong. And it's mostly that our brain doesn't actually kind of understand the difference between acute and chronic pain. That if we're in chronic pain, we still feel that there's a really strong danger signal that's going on. And so what happens if you feel like every move that you make is dangerous? Oh my goodness, that's horrible. That's like, if every move that you make, if every time that you move your shoulder, let's say, and you feel that pain, that you think that something dangerous is going on. Right, that you think that you're causing harm, that you think you're, and that's how the brain interprets it. And so, therefore, what's your experience? Well, your experience is actually going to be, you're going to protect that area. You're going to be in survival mode. You're going to trigger your sympathetic nervous system. And now we're in a completely different field, right? It's not just the pain. Now it's an entire survival, protection, sympathetic nervous system activation. So the first thing that we need to do is understand, is there danger that's still occurring? Is there something that A, needs to be repaired, send them to a surgeon? Is there something that's still dangerous, right? That it's sort of like, oh wow, you still have a fracture. You know, your fracture hasn't healed. Like that's like, right. We need to, right? That could cause pain for many months if that fracture doesn't, okay, we need to heal this fracture, because every time you do move, you're right, the bones are actually moving, and that's And so really ruling out anything that causes danger. And then once we do that, then going into a lot of, you know, if you can tell, kind of going from the danger to safety, to I'm okay. So that's the shift. That's the shift. It's sort of like, wow, for 10 years, I felt like I've been in danger. Well, then going from danger to safety, if you've been in danger for 10 years, is not going to be overnight, right? Mm-hmm. So all the wiring that has occurred in the brain of 10 years of feeling like you're in danger needs to be undone, and the nervous system needs to be then rebalanced. So a lot of techniques that involve rebalancing the nervous system with activation of the parasympathetic nervous system, thought retraining, you know, you mm-hmm. mentioned breath work, a ton of breath work. And we do, you know, we do like 10 different breath work practices mm-hmm. because the one that might activate the parasympathetic nervous yes. system the most from research might not resonate with you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Or you have a history of asthma and you're like, I can't do that practice. So
I learned that as a yoga teacher, like some pranayama would be amazing, but some people would get so agitated and run out of the room.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
And so we do a lot, you know, so it's a lot of education on, you know, and then increasing, sort of adding on various modalities mm-hmm. going, you know, each day is like a different modality, or go diving into the modalities. And, you know, little subtle tweaks. Maybe they're doing a breath practice already, but we can actually increase their exhalation timing or something like that, whatever it might be. So, a lot of education. And then it's starting to, it's sort of like taking the signal that's coming to the brain and interpreting it differently, because everything that we're going to be looking at in chronic pain, I can guarantee you, like when you look at the studies that are looking at sort of chronic pain, sort of novel things in chronic pain, it's like neuromodulation, let's say. So you're putting something either into the spine or into the brain that changes the way that the spine is sending the signal, or changing the way that the brain is interpreting the signal. You know, there are people who are looking at ultrasound guided. So an energy focused on different parts of the brain that interpret pain. So MRI ultrasound guided, you know, so an ultrasound beam to a certain area to try to change the way that that area is perceiving the signal that's coming up.
Mm.
Okay. Or you were looking at psychedelics, right? We're looking at psilocybe or LSD mm-hmm. In terms of, what does that do? Well, there is some research that shows that there is actually an acute anti-inflammatory effect. So instantaneously, you might be getting this anti-inflammatory effect, but over time, you're also getting this sort of increased neuroplasticity effect. Mm-hmm. What is that doing? Well, it's not, I can guarantee you, if you crushed your hand, okay, yes, you might have a subtle anti-inflammatory effect on that area. But over time, what we're looking at is the signal, whatever signal is still being produced by the crushed hand is still coming, but we're trying to change the way that the signal is being interpreted in the brain, so that what happens, if the signal is interpreted differently, you're going to have a different experience. And at the end of the day, that's actually what that's what medications do, is they either mm-hmm. decrease the inflammation if you're taking anti-inflammatories. If you're taking any of the other medications, like gabapentin or Lyrica, you know, you're decreasing the signal, you're decreasing the neuronal signal that's going to the brain. So you're changing the way that the signal is being mm-hmm. sent, or we're actually changing the way that the signal is being interpreted. So mm-hmm. just think of things like, you know, balancing your nervous system or meditation or breath work or any of these new practices as, I'm really changing the way that the signal is being interpreted by my brain to change the experience that I'm having.
Interesting. What do you think of functional neurology? Does that kind of fall into all this stuff as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, any sort of way of looking at functioning and looking at, you know, ways that we are altering the mechanisms of the brain, the perception of the brain and its output. That's really where we're, you know, that's really where we're going. Look, people are going to get into accidents. They're going to get in, you know, they're going to, you know, diseases are going to, you know, you might have, you might be born with a certain spinal malformation or something that causes severe pain. And so, you know, having ways of treating that and of changing the way that the signal is being sent and the way that the signal is being interpreted is going to be that's going to be huge, because if we can change the way that the signal sent and we can change the way that the signal is interpreted, that essentially is going to alleviate, it's going to change our experience. And at the end of the day, when you're in chronic pain, that's exactly what you want to do, is change your experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy, but I've seen it happen with people. I had actually a young man who had bought some of my courses and was in my private group, and he just was a mess, you know, couldn't eat anything besides meat, because vegetables or any kind of plant would send his body into like a huge inflammatory response. He was really sensitive to non-native EMF. It would give him like severe anxiety to the point where he would just shut down. Like his body was just going crazy, you know? And so he was trying a lot of the stuff that I was recommending with light and circadian rhythms and near infrared light and water. And, you know, that I kind of led him to the path of Dr. Joe Dispenza and his work. And he just reached out to me, I think it was last week. And he's like, hey, you know, I just want to let you know, I went to like a week long retreat with Dr. Dispenza. I was meditating on the beach with all these people. And ever since then, I've been fine and I can eat whatever I want and I can be in this high non-native EMF environment and I'm fine. And I just think more people need to, I was like, thank God, you know, but like, you can't explain that, you know, you want to keep on putting him down this dietary route and maybe give him some supplements and give him all these, you know, other things. Like, let's do some functional testing and see if you've got this, you know, virus or mold or whatever. And yeah, that those things might be there if you do the testing, but is throwing someone through a detox protocol and doing all that stuff actually going to help, you know, if it's, you're not addressing like these other foundational things. And so, and I've seen that with people overcoming horrible chronic illness. It's like, well, I worked on, you know, maybe like doing DNRS or like there's these other modalities of like addressing the nervous system and addressing the energy, and it works. And I think that's where a lot of my listeners, people that are in this community, they've done this, you know, allopathic didn't work for them. So then they went functional and blew the bank on all the testing and all that stuff. And now they're like, okay, that didn't work. So we have to look at some of these other things, and you're actually seeing that they're working as well, right?
Yeah. And the research is supporting it. You know, a lot of people need that research
to try it.
I use the research to try to convince them, because we can get into the mechanism of it. And when people understand the mechanism, like I can tell you that, you know, meditate, like mindfulness actually changes the way that the thalamus interprets sensory information. You're like, what? And I can show you the study that does it, you know, out of UC San Diego, for instance. And now you're like, oh, wait, so it's not just somebody just tells me to sit on them. It's like, it's actually changing the kid, like the way that my brain is filtering information. It's like, yeah, in real time. So why not practice it, right? Because the more you practice anything, just like playing a sport or playing a musical instrument, you get better at it. And your brain is actually going to change, and it's going to actually be better at that. So absolutely. Absolutely. And what you mentioned, Dr. Dispenza, you know, they are studying his meditation. I believe they got funding for a study at UC San Diego to look at his meditation in cancer.
Wow.
So, you know, that's what I love about him, is he's like, look, try these, but now let's test it.
Yeah.
Right. Now let's do the studies and not having any, like, just let's figure it out, right? Let's inquire about this. Yeah. And if it doesn't work, let's figure out what needs to be tweaked to help, right? Or for it to work, or what are the parameters that it may work in? And so, you know, that's why I think his work is instrumental too, because it's sort of like he's built this foundation. Now he's like, okay, now, you know, let's test it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, hopefully this conversation can offer people a great deal of hope if they are kind of in that spiral with their health and they're not getting anywhere with these kind of more traditional and even the alternative methods are not helping them, that there are other things that are being studied and looked at that are, I think, worth trying. It's like you've said, it's not going to hurt anyone. It's not going to hurt anything to try these things out, right?
Yeah, exactly. And having somebody, you know, guide you that, yeah. You know, it is important. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, that's what I say about mindfulness or meditation. It's sort of like, there's very few side effects.
Yeah, definitely.
Negative side effects.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
Yeah. Well, you've got some interesting work. You work with patients and you've written a few books. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what you're up to, where people can find you and some of the other things you're doing right now.
Yeah. So right now I do have a few books. I have three kids, and just going through, you know, kids' books and things like that. I was always really interested by, how much time is spent, you know, teaching them about the alphabet and teaching them about numbers and stuff like that. And how much, you know, how much time is spent from different, whether it's the parents, you know, going, you know, or school going like, here's an A, you know, here's a B and stuff like that. And I'm like, you know, that's a lot of time that goes into teaching them a you know, one letter. And that our society has sort of said, yes, this is what we want to, you know, this is what we want to spend so much time doing. And so I was like, you know, why not like try to teach them about other things like awareness or imagination or, you know, whatever it might be. And so I wrote three books. They're in a series. It starts with I Am and it goes to All One and then it goes to All Love. And it's sort of like a story line of personal inquiry of thoughts and emotions and sensations that appear in awareness and how a child would kind of start to differentiate that from self-identification and how to bring some awareness to the fact that they are not their thoughts, emotions, or sensations and that how these are sort of things that appear in awareness. And so it's a progression from I Am, which is sort of the understanding of I am aware, to All One, which is essentially that awareness is all one with the manifestations coming from awareness. So that's all one as well. You can't separate the manifestation from the source. And then as we spend time in awareness, that all love emerges as an emergence, not as a goal, but it just sort of, you know, it's not something that we're striving for. It just emerges. And so that's the first sort of series. And then my son and I actually wrote a book together. It's called Close Your Eyes, What Do You See? And it's a book about when I would put him to bed, sometimes he'd open his eyes and I go, oh, what, you know, what's wrong? He goes, oh, I was seeing some weird shapes and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, isn't that interesting that you can actually see things when your eyes are closed, right? He's like, yeah, you know? And then so I'd ask him like, what do you see now? And what do you see now? Right. And so it kind of got into this dialogue of like, did you know that you can change the things that you see when you close your eyes? And he's like, no, like, well, he's like, what do you mean by that? Well, you know, just like, what do you want to imagine? Right. And all of a sudden he like literally just asking that question, right, would trigger him, would be like, oh, I'm like, what did you do fun today? He's like, oh, I was playing soccer with, I'm like, well, see yourself playing soccer with your friends on the field. And instantaneously, right, the image that was there prior changed. And he's like, oh, he's like, wow, right? So now this is conscious imagination, essentially. Right? And so it's a dialogue of him and I sort of consciously imagining something and having him actively, you know, shift like, oh, sometimes I see, you know, dragons and scary things and Oh, but you can actually consciously, I can in my mind's eye, I can consciously shift what I'm seeing or paying attention to, and I can create this little, you know, imagination. And so it's a dialogue between him and I, and then sort of instructions for conscious imagination or manifestation at the end. And then going back, so that's the fourth book is Close Your Eyes, What Do You See? And then the fifth book, it just came out, is again going back to this alphabet idea, is, you know, A is for Apple. A lot of books on the alphabet for kids. And so I was like, you know, I would love to introduce my kids to different words than that early on, even if it's, you know, even if they don't know what it is, that shouldn't stop us from introducing it. Just like they don't know what the letter A is before we introduce it to them, but we spend so much time introducing it to them and then shoving it into their face. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, well, instead of shoving the letter A, you know, into their face and having it, why don't we shove things like awareness into their face and take as much time, you know, if you just think of like, take as much time as you did teaching somebody how to write the letter A, as you did teaching them about what awareness is, maybe the world would be in a different place. And maybe the parents or the teachers would actually be educated, because they would actually have to know what awareness is prior to teaching it. Exactly. And so it's kind of like this, it's sort of like a, hey, if you don't know the words, look them up yourself before you talk to your kids about it. Apple is easy. But let's focus more time on like talking to kids about awareness and attention, and love and kindness and things like that, and be like, oh, what is kindness? What is love? What is awareness? What is, you know, what is your attention? And so it's A is for awareness, and it's an alphabet book, for all ages, essentially. And so what the recommendation is read the words. Right? Maybe take one word a day or one letter a day and really understand for yourself the meaning of those words and teach them to somebody, teach them to your kids, bringing them up, even if it's just, you know, to me, it's always a seed, right? So read the words to your child. They might not know what it is, but that's perfectly fine. That's what education is, right? As you introduce that initial seed, and then they're like, oh, awareness, attention. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, my mom or dad mention those words before, right? Let me look them up. What do they mean? Or, you know, you look them up for yourself. And kind of, you know, and so each word can be a little, it can be a slight meditation, each, you know, kind of like meditating on the word for what that means for yourself. And then teaching it to our kids and you know, having them understand like, what is attention?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like that's, you know, to me, that'd be like, wow, let's take as much time as we teach the letter A to somebody to teach them about their attention.
I love
and
that.
Not just pay attention. Well, what is that?
Right.
Like, what does that mean? Like,
where are you putting your energy? Like, what are you focusing on, and how does that impact how you feel, and how does that impact your experience of the world? And yeah, it's very interesting to think about, especially, you know, having a 14-month-old and you read to them all the time. You know, I've been reading to him since he was just little itty bitty. And then now all the little words are popping out, little phrases just here and there. And it's like, yeah, he's been listening the whole time, you know, and kind of just taking it all in. And so that's just children. They're kind of like these sponges. And that's why we have to be aware of the things that we're putting in their field. And it's fun. It's an interesting experience for sure.
Exactly.
Wonderful. And if people, so I'll make sure to put the links to all your books in the show notes. And if you're practicing medicine still, if people are interested in kind of what you're doing with pain management, medicine, how could they find you?
Well, the web is probably, you know, going on online and finding, my email is holdingspace18@gmail.com. And then I'm on Instagram at Dr. Zapatera.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure I have that all linked in the show notes. And, this has been a super interesting, fun conversation, and I'm excited to share it with everyone. So thank you so much for being here.
Great. Yeah. Thank you for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did with Dr. Zapatera. So much great information. Please head to the show notes, get his children's book, support his work. I think it is so needed and so refreshing in the world of alternative health and healing. Just, we need this message out there more and more and more. So thank you so much for listening. Again, if you did enjoy the show, make sure to share it with a friend or family member. Leave us that review over on Apple or Spotify to help get the message out to more and more people. And thank you for being here. Thank you for being a part of this community. It is the last week of December here. We are almost in the new year. You may even be listening to this in the new year. So it's this time of year where we are reflective about our health, where we want to possibly look at shifting some things. And so I think this episode is appropriate for that, and looking at our health not through this black and white lens of the biochemical model, or even getting caught up in the circadian quantum model. There's so much more for us to look at, and I hope that this episode was maybe a doorway for you to take a look at some things. So it was for me, 100%. All right, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk with you again next week.